Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Monday, February 13th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And we also have with us Vice Chair Guerra. Before we start, just a reminder, please mute your phones. And on today's schedule, we are going to be taking up the introduction of HB 115, which is the income tax, PFD credit, and permanent fund income bill. Today, the plan is for an introduction of the bill, a brief walkthrough of the sectional, followed by a PowerPoint presentation. And at this time, I'd like to bring up Tanika Hansen, aide to Representative Seaton, as well as my aide, Jane Pearson, to the table, please. And since we have two voices speaking, if you could just please remember to identify yourself prior to speaking for transcription purposes. And Ms. Hansen, if you could put yourself on the record and begin your introduction and presentation on HB 115. Thanks for being here.
For the record, my name is Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Paul Seaton. So House Bill 115, or the State Revenue Restructuring Act, its goal is to create a balanced and stable and sustainable approach to resolving our state deficit for now and for future lapses. The stable fiscal plan requires multiple approaches and should be addressed this year because our reserve account is running low. For over 30 years, the state has relied almost exclusively on volatile resource revenues, which has led to years where the state budget has been high, with large capital budgets creating infrastructure throughout the state. But it has also led to years where the budget has contracted quickly to try and match reduced revenue streams, leaving little money to maintain our existing infrastructure or for our state needs. State government does not function very efficiently or effectively with so much volatility. Volatility in state government is also unhealthy for the economy. As we heard from Mr. King on Friday, businesses do not feel comfortable investing in the state when they don't know what things will look like next year or the year after that. We've heard from business leaders throughout the state that uncertainty is freezing their investment decisions. And we also see the effect of volatility on the state's credit rating. Even though the state of Alaska has more assets than most other states, all three credit rating agencies downgraded our rating last year. Without a fiscal plan, it seems likely they would downgrade us again at the end of this year, because without a stable and sustainable plan for the rating agencies, it's hard for them to predict what the state finances will look like in the next few years. So to provide business leaders and rating agencies with the confidence they need to invest in Alaska, the legislature should consider a fiscal plan that will stabilize state revenues and will be sustainable into the future, and should be a comprehensive solution, not just a partial one, so we do not return with the same questions of uncertainty next year. So how does this bill create a stable plan? It reduces volatility in the state budget by diversifying our revenue sources from mainly one single source, oil, to many. First, it will utilize the permanent fund based on a 4.75% of the market value. The fund is invested in a diversified portfolio, which means it's protected from fluctuations in value from just one investment or type or another. And as was demonstrated last week by David Teal, a percent of market value draw is a more stable draw than our current way of calculating income from the fund. And in addition to this, the State Revenue Restructuring Act, House Bill 115, implements a modest income tax, which will further diversify state revenues and protect against fluctuations in any one source. And how is this a sustainable approach? The intent with this legislation is to craft a framework that won't drain value from our savings so that they are preserved into the future for the next generation of Alaskans. So to achieve this, you want to set a sustainable draw on the earnings so that the fund will be allowed to grow and continue to maintain the same value for future Alaskans as it has for us today. So draw rates that are too high could risk this value if they're drawing above the rate of inflation. And how does this bill create a balanced approach? The intent of the revenue sources in this bill are to ask every Alaskan and every non-resident worker to contribute to the state services that we are all utilizing, while recognizing that some have more ability to contribute than others. The necessary restructuring of the permanent fund earnings and of the dividend, which is paid out of that same earning account, will impact every Alaskan, but will not impact non-residents. Rural Alaskans and low-income Alaskans, especially those with families, will feel this restructuring more than higher-income families. A progressive income tax based on 15% of the federal tax liability will offset this impact by collecting revenues from non-residents and also from those with higher incomes. It will also include a $25 minimum tax, which will be paid by all filers, ensuring that most Alaskans will be contributing to this revenue source. So the State Revenue Restructuring Act is a foundation for a fiscal plan that should be stable, sustainable over the long term, and comprehensive to help remove the uncertainty that is freezing business investment and credit ratings in the state currently.
Well, good. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. And we'll have next up my aide, Jane Pearson, but are there any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, Jane, if you could go through the sectional.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Neil Foster, and I'd like to quickly run you through the sectional. Section 1 clarifies that all components of the bill are part of a comprehensive revenue act. Section 2 amends AS 3713-140, net income to the permanent fund dividend fund, to remove income available for distribution and adds market value to this section title. Section 3 adds a new subsection B to AS 3713-140, determining the amount available for distribution each year from the earnings reserve account equal to 4.7% of market value of the entire fund, and defines how the average market value of the fund is calculated. Section 4 states that 33% of the amount available for distribution under AS 3713-140 may be directed to the dividend and 67% to the general fund. Section 5 amends AS 3713-145D relating to the Amaretta Hess settlement to clarify that income from the settlement will not be used for distribution, and it additionally removes references to subsection C relating to inflation proofing, which is repealed by this act. Section 6 provides that money from the earnings reserve may be transferred to the principal of the permanent fund for purposes of inflation proofing when the corpus of the fund, when the value of the earnings reserve account is four times the annual amount calculated under AS 3713-140B. Section 7 includes the unexpended balance of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's budget in the calculation of the fund's market value. This budget balance is already calculated as part of the net income of the fund under current law. Section 8 clarifies that income from the Mental Health Trust Fund, which is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, is not included in the market value of the permanent fund. Section 9 asserts that the income of the Mental Health Trust shall continue to be calculated as before in the same manner as the net income of the entire fund. Section 10 is the start of the income tax section. Section 10, AS 4305-045A, states there is a penalty if a state income form is not filed electronically. However, individuals are exempt from the penalty. You'll see this coming up on page 16, line 13, on page 6, line 13, excuse me. Section 11 creates the individual income tax within AS 43. Subsection 4320.010 imposes an income tax and long-term capital gains tax on residents, as well as non-residents, with income from within the state. The tax is equal to 15% of the taxpayer's total federal income tax due, or $25, whichever is greater. Long-term capital gains are additionally taxed at the lesser of 10% of the federal tax rate difference between earned income and capital gains. Currently, capital gains are taxed by the federal government at a lower rate than earned income. Subsection 4322.020 establishes how a taxpayer will submit the tax return. It clarifies that this tax is due and payable to the department at the same time and in the same manner as tax payable to the IRS for federal taxes. Section 4322.030 defines income from sources in the state for the purposes of this tax. Subsection 4322.035 provides a credit to residents for taxes paid to another state based on income earned in the other state, ensuring a resident is not taxed twice on the same income. Section 4322.040 states a person may choose to apply some or all of their PFD as a refundable tax payment to their upcoming state income tax due. Any remaining dividend after the payment will be refunded to the applicant. Section 4322.050 establishes how taxes will be withheld by employers making payments of wages or salaries or a person paying crew shares, similar to the way in which employers withhold federal income taxes. Section 4322.055 allows a person's income tax information to be shared with a banking institute to verify direct deposits of refunds. Section 4322.060 authorizes the department to create all necessary forms and adopt regulations to implement the tax. Section 4322.190 provides definition of terms used in this section, including the definition of resident. That ends the income tax section. Section 12 directs the Permanent Fund Division to create a place on the Permanent Fund Dividend application where an applicant may choose to apply some or all of their Permanent Fund Dividend to pay their state income tax. Section 13 is the repealers. It repeals AS 3713-145C, which is inflation proofing of the permanent fund. It also repeals sections relating to a formal tax credit for political contributions that existed under the prior income tax, which was repealed in 1980. Section 14 clarifies that the state income tax created under Section 11 of this Act only goes into effect starting on January 1, 2018, and will not be applied to any income earned prior to that date. Section 15 authorizes the Department of Revenue to adopt regulations to implement this Act. Section 16 is a retroactivity clause. If Sections 2 through 9 take effect after June 30th of 2017, Sections 2 through 9 are retroactive to June 30th of 2017. The appropriation from the earnings reserve described in Sections 2 through 4 will be applicable in the fiscal year 2017. Section 17, Sections 2 through 9, and Sections 15 and 16 relating to the earnings reserve account and the permanent fund and earning reserves have an immediate effective date. And Section 14, the effective date of the Act, except for those noted in Section 17 above, is January 1st, 2018.
We're good. Thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Pearson? We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the Chair. Ms. Pearson, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, which is fine. We'll just get it at some point. The capital gains tax, when I first read the bill, I understood it as a 10% tax on capital gains. But if I look through the sectional, it seems more complex than that. Is that something we want to address later on, or is that something?
And if I could, I just want to recognize that we were joined earlier by Representative Pruitt. Welcome.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I am not sure I can answer that.
Sure.
This is Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. I had planned to note that some in the PowerPoint, but basically it's 10% would be the maximum tax on capital gains. That tax could change if the federal government changed the differential between the capital gains rate that they're charged, that they put on long-term capital gains currently, and you know if they increase that rate in the future, our rate would decrease.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. But based on existing law right now, it's a 10% tax on capital gains, short-term and long-term, or is there a different
long-term. Long-term capital gains.
And then through the chair.
Follow-up.
Is there a provision on short-term capital gains or no?
No. Short-term capital gains under federal law are currently taxed at the same rate as other income.
Thanks.
Okay. Are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, we'll move on. Ms. Hansen, I believe you have a PowerPoint.
So Alaska is currently undergoing some economic contractions. How big this recession ends up being will depend in part on the approach the legislature takes to address the deficit that we are facing. And a diversified approach will help minimize that impact on any one group of Alaskans and should help provide for a smoother transition for the economy as a whole. So under legislation being considered in the House, there are four key pillars to this diversified plan. One is a structured use of the permanent fund earnings reserve, the state's single biggest asset. Another is new revenue from broad-based tax, which will allow everyone to contribute to the services that we are utilizing. A third is protecting and maintaining a permanent fund dividend for Alaskans within this restructuring of the earnings reserve. And a fourth is smart budget cuts while maintaining functioning core services. Smart budget cuts can include reductions to some of our liabilities, such as the oil and gas credit liability that the state currently has. So not all of these components will be addressed in one legislation, but this act, the State Revenue Restructuring Act, will consider a structured use of the permanent fund earnings reserve, new revenue from a broad-based tax, and a protected structure for the dividend. So the changes that are made to the use of the permanent fund earnings come down to 4 points. First, there'll be an annual draw based on 4.75% of the permanent fund's full value. And inflation proofing of the principal of the fund will be contingent on surpluses in the earnings reserve. So the current annual transfer from the earnings reserve to the principal for inflation proofing is being replaced here. And in years when the balance of the earnings reserve account exceeds 4 times the percent of market value draw calculated for the general fund and the dividend, then that excess that is in the earnings reserve will be transferred to the principal. Of the 4.75% that is drawn or that is available for distribution, 1/3 or 33% of it will be transferred directly to the dividend fund for the permanent fund dividends. And 2/3 or 67% of that draw from the earnings reserve will go to the general fund. And one final component of the bill that relates to the permanent fund earnings is that the permanent fund dividend that Alaskan residents receive will have an option to apply that against your state income tax due. This option would be entirely voluntary and would be just a checkbox on the dividend application. So how would the income tax be implemented? I want to note that the numbers on these slides are based on 2015 estimates from the Department of Revenue. We just got updated fiscal notes today, so they're slightly changed, and we didn't have a chance to update the PowerPoint slide in that time. But the income tax will be 15% of federal liability due, so that's our intent is that would be line 56 on the federal 1040 form. So that would capture, that would be your adjusted gross income minus the standard deductions and many common exemptions and credits, but would not include the self-employment tax and some other more specialized taxes that are generally considered beyond the traditional idea of income. It's all, it also excludes things like federal bonds, which states aren't able, aren't supposed to tax, and how that would translate exactly will be created through regulation by Department of Revenue. This would also not include the earned income tax credit, which is much, which comes after your federal taxes due. Not everyone will have a federal tax liability. However, everyone who files a federal income tax form will at least pay a minimum tax of $25. So the $25 minimum tax was not included in those 2015 estimates, so they're not on this slide. I think if you look at the fiscal note, it was about $2 million in the first year of implementation. And additionally, the income tax will include a 10% tax on long-term capital gains. As discussed previously, the federal government currently taxes long-term capital gains differently than it taxes short-term capital gains or other forms of income. For the lowest tax brackets, long-term capital gains are not taxed at all. For the tax brackets where other incomes are taxed between 25 and 35%, the federal government currently taxes long-term capital gains at 15%. So by adding an additional 10% Alaskan tax on long-term capital gains, that differential between other incomes and long-term capital gains will be equalized. And again, that's the in the bill, there's a calculation for if the federal government were to change that so that long-term capital gains at the federal level were taxed at an amount closer to what other income is taxed at, then our tax rate on long-term capital gains would adjust accordingly.
I've got a question from Representative Pruitt.
There's some confusing things on this. It's okay. I've got some clarification. Sure. So are you saying that it would be a 25% tax, that it's 15 plus 10? Are you saying that it would be, as opposed to how it's 15% of federal liability, making it, you know, based on your numbers here, so much, are you just flat out going 10% of whatever the gains are, that's going to be our tax? Is that
so
what you're doing?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the capital gains are reported on your federal taxes. And so your capital gains will be taxed at that 15% of federal tax liability. However, the capital gains that you report there are on your federal tax liability are taxed at between 0 and 15% compared to other income, which is taxed at a higher rate. So there will also be a 10% tax specifically on those long-term capital gains, on the taxable income from long-term capital gains, which would mean for somebody who has long-term capital gains, who's paying taxes in Alaska, what they are paying in taxes on long-term capital gains will equal the same tax rate that they are paying on other income.
So how would that impact 401ks and retirees? Because they're going to have, you know, they're going to, that's a long-term capital gains. And so are we going to be putting a 10% gain on there, or is there exemptions for them?
I would defer that question to Department of Revenue. It's got a little bit more knowledge of the tax codes. I know that some retirement income has different taxing rules at the federal level, which means the way it's taxed at the state level will be different as well.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm sure I'll have other questions, but I just wanted to clarify that one. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Pruitt. We do have the Department of Revenue on here online if you would like.
You know, and I'll leave it up to you. We can ask that later on. I mean, I really, mostly I wanted to ask now just to make sure I understood that one clear. I can ask it later if you need me to.
Brandon Spanos, are you online? we can circle back to this. Representative Wilson and then Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we are not doing an additional tax on short-term capital gains, only long-term?
Correct.
And follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
And those would be only for residents that would pay that, not?
This calculation would also apply to any income earned within the state.
Like what? I know the stocks and bonds and stuff like that, that would not be in here. So are we talking just real estate at this point?
So stocks and bonds are in the definition for potential income earned within the state. If you Section 4322030 defines income from sources in the state, which is for the purposes of non-residents, and that includes income from stocks, bonds, notes, bank deposits, and other intangible personal property having a taxable or business interest in the state.
So I've done taxes for a long time for a whole bunch of different states, so this is a new one to me. Normally, if you have long-term capital gains or short-term, it's usually done in the state you reside in, not the state that you work in. So was this taken off of some other state that I'm not aware of, that I'm an out-of-state, so I live in Washington state. I can understand that my income that I earn in Alaska would be taxed. But now, although I'm making all of my stocks or whatever in the state of Washington, not necessarily Alaska, just because I work in the state of Alaska, now I'm also going to have my long-term capital gains taxed by the Alaska standard. Is that correct?
Ms. Hansen?
Through the chair, I believe because it is on income from a source in the state, it would have to be a stocks or bonds that were considered a source in the state. And so Mr. Spanos might be able to speak more directly to how that's differentiated. But you wouldn't be taxed on all of your long-term capital gains.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson?
I'm too confused to ask a question because, I mean, I don't know what besides real estate maybe, but that's usually not counted as a long-term capital gain. And so I can't think of anything you would purchase within the state itself that would have a long-term capital gain.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, again, the definition for the different incomes that are considered from the source in the state, that's on page 6, line number, subsection 4 and 5. But I would defer to Mr. Spanos to provide examples of stocks and bonds.
Mr. Spanos, are you online?
The state.
Yes, I am.
Were you able to hear the question, Mr. Spanos?
I believe I did hear the question. If I understood correctly, it was what long-term capital gains would be CITUS to Alaska, other than real property.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson?
If I'm not a resident, I mean, I understand if I'm a resident, this all applies to me as a resident. But I'm trying to, and I'm not sure real estate is usually counted on your taxes as a long-term capital gain. Normally stocks and bonds, but what if I'm out of state, what would qualify as an out-of-state resident as a capital gain from within the state of Alaska?
I'm sure through the chair, the real estate would be for it's a good example. So if I am a non-resident and I own real estate in the state and I'm holding it for investment purposes and I sell it at a gain, that would be and I've held it for more than a year, it would be a long-term capital gain. I would owe long-term capital gain rates on my federal tax return. If this bill were to pass in Alaska, I would also owe the long-term capital gain rate to Alaska in addition to that 15% that would be already taxed through my regular federal income tax liability. Other income sources could be a trust would be an example. If I have income earned through a trust up in Alaska that's incorporated here and my funds are held here, that could be a long-term capital gain.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you have other examples, please do. And then the vice versa, if I'm an Alaska resident and say I own property somewhere else, or, you know, am I going to be taxed on that in the state, even though I'm a resident, but my holding is not here?
Yes, through the chair, if I'm a resident of the state and my assets are not in Alaska, as long as they are not taxed by another state, then they would be taxed here. The bill has a credit for taxes paid in other states. So if I have, maybe we don't even talk about the capital gain. If I just have income from a rental in another state, that would be taxed by the other state, and I could get a credit for it in Alaska, and I wouldn't pay the tax twice. If it's a long-term capital gain, it would be similar. If I sold a property, an investment property in another state, and that state taxed that property, they could file for a credit. Now, if the state has a higher tax than Alaska, then I would get the tax up to the amount that I would have paid in Alaska. If it's a lower value or a lower rate than this, which I don't believe any other state has, then I would pay the difference.
Okay. And one last follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
First of all what you just said is a nightmare. I've done that with states before. And when you're trying to figure out who to credit whom, it's, luckily they have H&R Block online that you can do. But on the question, and this may be to you, Mr. Chairman, versus the others, I don't know a lot about the trust market that we have here, but I hear that it brings in a lot of revenue into the state. And from what I'm able to understand here, that this could have a huge negative effect, and we could lose, just from I barely know about the bill and the discussion we have here, they may go somewhere else. So I'd like to make sure that somewhere during this discussion that we hear from somebody who knows what the trust market is in Alaska, what kind of revenue is brought in, and what repercussions could be based on this capital gains portion of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, through the chair.
Or Ms. Tanika Henson?
When we were drafting this section, we had originally had some reference to trust, which has since been removed. So I will follow up with Mr. Spanos and see. You know, he mentioned trust. We had modified some language that had mentioned trust and taken it out. So I will follow up with him and see if Department of Revenue is interpreting it differently, or if it was based on previous income tax versions in previous years that had included that language.
Thank you. We've got two questions, one from Representative Guttenberg and then Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The gentleman we had here on Friday talked about not tying it too tightly to the federal liability in case things change on that and have unintended consequences for us. And we have this estimate for income tax and refundable PFD tax payments. But I think we're getting into the questions on the mechanics of how this works and what we're taxing and what we're not. It maybe if we had a one-pager on definitions and the mechanics of what we're actually doing besides just estimates, it might help us be on the same page. Thank you.
We'll work to get that to the members. Okay, we've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly have a number of questions, but totally agree that we have to raise revenue in the state. I do have questions about the bill. First of all, Ms. Hansen or maybe Mr. Spanos, just so nobody misinterprets this bill, when you say 15% of federal tax liability, that means 15 one-hundredths of the federal tax, right?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's correct. In the backup documents, you should have that estimated income tax, and so it shows the, you know, by differing income levels, what their tax would be, and then you take 15% of that payment, which equals between, you know, 1.1% to, you know, 3% of their gross income.
Through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
Yeah, just so people understand, I know some people misinterpreted this as a 15% tax on income, which it's not. So the way it works is you would take your federal tax rate. Let's say your federal tax rate is 25%. 15% of that is 3.75%. So if you were in a 25% tax bracket on the under your federal tax rate, then this bill at 15% of your federal tax liability would be something like a 3.75% rate for that bracket. Is that correct?
Representative Gehr, through the chair, that sounds correct. I'd have to sit down, have the numbers in front of me to actually confirm your math, but sounds correct.
Thanks.
On that point, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the tables, the tax tables that are in your packet, you'll see that the bottom two lines are federal tax as a percent of gross income, and in the just above that is the Alaska tax as a percent of gross income. So you can go for any, whether it's $50,000, married, single, or if you want to go up to the higher ones that go up to $800,000 or $900,000, and you can read exactly what the tax rate is. At $800,000, you would have 32.38% federal tax, and you would have 4.86% Alaska tax. So that's 15% of the federal tax rate, and those are all listed out in those tables. So you can, people can go if they want $150,000, I'll see it's 2.57% if you're single with two children. Right, so those are provided in there.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just trying to make this as simple as possible. But the tax rate in this bill is 15% of your federal tax rate, and so just if I have my math right and my calculator has my math right, 15% of a 25% federal tax is a 3.75% tax. I just don't want anybody walking around saying this bill is imposing a 15% tax when it's not. I trust my math on that, at least 15% of a 25% tax rate. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Are there any further questions of the committee? Follow-up, Representative Guerra, and then Representative Wilson.
Thank you. There's the question of trusts, and certainly we'll get more information on this. This trust industry it's an odd industry in the state. We're not sure how many bankers and attorneys it benefits. My understanding is, since you can only tax Alaska income, we can't tax Utah income, we can't tax income from somebody who lives in New York making money in New York. My understanding of the trust issue is this. If you're a client from New York City and all of your stuff is publicly traded stocks on the New York Stock Exchange and you have a banker or an attorney up here, that person and their trust is not going to be taxed, really. The lawyer and the banker up here who make income in Alaska off that trust will probably be taxed. But we'll probably get a more accurate answer later, but I think you're only allowed to tax Alaska income and income made in Alaska. So I think the trust issue is that person outside, if all their investments are outside investments and they don't really touch Alaska, it's really just the lawyers and the accountants who are going to get taxed up here.
Okay, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guerra and then Representative Pruitt. Wilson and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure it's not as simple as what the representative said, because we're using the front sheet, if I'm understanding correctly. So I'm going to go down, I'm going to put in my income, I'm going to put in my interest, I'm going to put down whether I had gains or losses possibly in the stock market, gains or losses in business or real estate, if I understand this correctly. And then there's a whole section of other deductions I could take before I actually get to my gross wages. So somebody who has, you know, this has only income and doesn't do any of those other things are going to have a higher federal tax liability than someone who can afford to invest in and have, you know, maybe real estate that's going on. So this is not just as simple as where I have income. I'm going to just take off two things that this says here, which is less standard deduction, less, you know, personal exemptions. You can have two people next to each other with the same wages, but actually pay very different on this income tax. Is that not correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it it is based on federal tax liability, so if they are paying a different federal tax liability, that is correct.
Follow-up.
Follow-up.
But the general population doesn't necessarily know. I mean, they take their taxes, they get them done. And so I just want to make sure, we're saying federal liability, that's true. But when we start talking about what's going to be taxed on your income, that's going to be very different. And I'll give an example. I own my own home. My kids have all moved out now. So I basically have my income plus my husband's Social Security come down. You've got somebody who doesn't own their home and has a big payment. That's all going to come off, you know, of here. So they're going to pay less on their income than I am on mine. And then going long-term to short-term, people might be more apt to sell their stuff, you know, before they have the long-term gain. So there's a lot of things. Are we going to have a chart that will actually show up here, maybe a side-by-side, somebody who has kids and has all those deductions versus just maybe a couple who, I guess, older, sorry, I have to say that about myself, you know, that doesn't have all those deductions and what the liability would look like and then the tax would at the end of that? I mean, it would be nice to have side-by-side of two different families, you know, having that, because I think it would show that the difference in what we're going to pay are very different, and it may be a little clearer for people to understand who don't actually sit down there and try to do their own taxes because they just take them in. That would be very helpful.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I just want to add, tomorrow we were hoping to focus more on the questions, and I just wanted to add that we do have some other folks who will be available tomorrow. The Department of Law will be here tomorrow. Permanent Fund Corporation will be online. We'll also have Carl Davis from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. With that, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. No, I just wanted to actually clarify, because we had heard earlier that if there was income derived from another state, it would be taxed. But Representative Garrett just mentioned that we shouldn't be able to tax if it's income made in another state. And I just want to clarify, I'm not sure. If someone might be able to clarify that for me.
Representative Garrett?
Yeah. Representative Pruitt through the chair. For a non-resident, the only thing that can be taxed is income from the state. For an Alaskan resident, all income is taxable, but you have credits against anything that's been taxed in another state so that you won't be paying on that income. And there are only, I believe it's six other states that don't have income taxes. They have sales taxes instead. I'll have to check on that. And so most of those other states, you would be essentially, most of your income would be just your Alaskan income because you'd already be paying the tax in another state.
Okay, I just wanted that clarification. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Representative Pruitt. Any further questions of the committee? Representative Seaton?
Just a clarification. If you are Alaskan, or if you're a non-Alaskan, and you reside in a state that doesn't have an income tax, you're not going to get credit for income you made in that state if you were an Alaskan taxpayer. If you have income in a state in which you have an income tax, you'll get a credit on that. So it depends on which state you reside in, whether it has an income tax like 41 other states do, or from a state which does not have an income tax, then you wouldn't get credit for that other income.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
And do you get credit for the amount you paid to that other state, or do you have to figure out whether it was calculated in the same fashion as if you were here? So it would just be so let's say in Washington I paid $100 to the state, I would still have to figure out, it wouldn't just be the $100 I would get credit, it would be only the part that Alaska could have taxed, not the whole credit, correct?
Representative Seaton?
If the state does not have an income tax, then there wouldn't be any credit. If the state does have an income tax, there can be a credit for the amount up to the amount that would have been charged on that income from Alaska. So in other words, if you were from California and it had a 13% gross tax, then you wouldn't be able to subtract more tax from your Alaska earnings than you'd still have to pay your 15% of your federal tax liability on the money earned in Alaska.
I don't think that's follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Okay, so I'll use Missouri as an example because I've done it a bunch of times because they do that. They give you a lot of credit, but you only do it on the percentage. So if I live in Illinois and I have to pay Missouri taxes, you know, one person may work in Illinois, the other person works in Missouri. So everything has to be divided up on their tax return of what was Illinois, what was Missouri. So this would be the same thing. You would have Alaska, and then you would have Washington, especially if you're two wage earners. And so then once that form, whatever it would look like in Alaska, you would only get credit then for your wages in Alaska. You won't, not the tax you paid on your spouses for working in Washington. So would, so you would have to do that calculation. Is that true?
Representative Seaton.
We'll get the Revenue Department in here to explain all those.
That's fine. We can wait tomorrow.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that it's defined on page 7, but I think the Revenue Department would give the cleanest explanation of how it functions.
Okay, we'll get Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess we'll have more discussion on this. The taxable income is all discussed on pages 6 and 7 of the bill, so 0.030 and 0.035. If you're an out-of-state worker, if you're an out-of-state worker who comes to the state, pays nothing here, and then takes your money out, like is currently the case, now if you come up and you work on the North Slope, you'll pay taxes on the money you earn in the state. You won't be able to take everything out of the state. And then the credit part is described in 0.035, and that only applies to residents of the state of Alaska. Obviously, we can have more discussion, but you're paying income on all your income earned in the state. So out-of-state workers will now have to start contributing to the state where they come to work and leave. And then if you're a resident and you've paid taxes in another state for income from that other state, you get a credit, so you're not being double taxed on it. 030 and 035, but yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's as well as I can do to direct people to the parts of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Any further questions of the committee? Please proceed with your presentation, Ms. Hansen.
So when we were just speaking of non-residents, again, this slide is based on the estimates from 2015. We just got an updated fiscal note, which didn't break out the income in the same manner as that previous estimate, so I can't directly update the amount estimated to be coming from non-residents. But in 2015, over 90,000 non-residents worked in the state and took more than $2.7 billion in wages out of state with them. And as is pointed out in the fiscal note and in the bill, the income tax will be implemented starting January 1st, 2018. So the state, which functions on a fiscal year, will only see, for the first year, will only see half of that revenue because it'll be half of a fiscal year that they're collecting for. The estimated revenue for that in the new fiscal note, I think, was $321 million versus the approximated $300 that I have here on the slide. So this is a chart showing the existing flow into the permanent fund and out of the permanent fund. Existing, we have 25% to 30% of oil royalties that go into the permanent fund, and the rest of the royalties go to the general fund. Then the earnings on the investments come out of the principal, go into the earnings reserve, which can be spent by any appropriation. Historically, the legislature hasn't chosen to appropriate from that fund except for the dividend and for inflation proofing, but that option exists today. And we also have on here the distributable income out of the earnings reserve, which is the way we currently pay the dividend, and that calculation is based on 21% of the five-year average of the net income of the fund. Net income of the fund is does not include unrealized gains or losses. So as was demonstrated by David Teal last week, that can be highly variable. You can have a year of negative realized earnings, which is why we have seen in dividends fluctuating between $700 and $2,200. So that's the current way that the dividend is calculated. and the current way that money can be appropriated from the earnings reserve. So under the bill, one additional cash flow we'll have, which we've been discussing, is the income tax. Again, we just got the updated fiscal note, so the amount on here is not the updated current amount, but it will be that 15% of federal income tax due and 10% of long-term capital gains, which will go directly to the general fund. Additionally, the bill makes changes to how the earnings from the permanent fund that come out of the earnings reserve account are considered available for distribution. Previously, we had that calculation based on the five-year average, 21% of the statutory net income. Now we are going to be calculating it based on a percent of the market value of the entire fund. This will also be averaged over 5 or 6 years, but instead of being based on just the earnings, this net income, it'll be based on the whole value of the fund, which is a more stable calculation. So two-thirds of that draw that comes out of the earnings reserve, that structured draw of 4.75%, will be going into the general fund. It's about $1.5 billion in FY18 and $1.59 billion in FY19, according to legislative finance numbers. According to the Department of Revenue's estimate on their fiscal note, it's actually closer to $1.6 billion in FY19. I think that the legislative finance and Department of Revenue have slightly different assumptions for the earnings over the next couple of years, but on Wednesday they will both be available to answer questions on that. The other third of that 4.75% of market value draw will be sent directly to the dividend fund, which is where the current draw from the earnings reserve goes directly to the dividend fund as well. So that third will not be going through the general fund. It will be going straight into the dividend fund for calculating this year's dividend. And the value of that draw for FY18 is, I think, $762 million and would be an estimated $1,100 dividend. So this slide looks at how this change affects the dividend that comes out to Alaskans. Once that draw from the earnings reserve is put into the dividend fund, it's calculated in the same manner that it's calculated today, based on the percentage of the divided by the percentage of the population. There's garnishments that the state takes in a certain order. So all of that all will happen exactly the same way that it happens today. Residents will still have the option to donate to Pick, Click, Give or to college funds. But in addition, they will have another option to choose to use that dividend as a payment against their state income tax due. Again, this would be completely optional and be selected on their application. And if they did choose that option, then once they filed their taxes with the state, they would receive any additional amount of the dividend as a refund. If they didn't select that option, then they would receive the dividend just as they have every year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just trying to understand the logistics of that. So if through the year there's going to be withholdings, I would I believe from reading this and just like we would typically understand from the federal government. So if you choose to go with that, could I then say at the beginning of the year I choose not to have withholdings, kind of like a W-2 type scenario would be, or W-4 type scenario would be, and say no, don't take anything out because I have an expectation that I'm not going to have higher than $1,000 worth of state tax, and then kind of make that estimate that it would come from the permanent fund. And then what happens if at the end of the year I estimated it wrong, or the permanent fund comes out at a different rate, or the legislature takes all of it away, which they tend to be creeping in that direction. How in the world, how do you manage? Or like last year, where the permanent fund was, you know, people were expecting 2,000 and it ended up being 1,000. I just want to understand the logistics of how this particular thing is going to work in terms of the burden on the individual and the burden on the state for managing that. It sounds incredibly complex, and what can you tell me about how this is going to operate?
Ms. Henson?
Representative Pruitt through the chair. As far as the really technical details of how it'll flow through the Department of Revenue, we've spoken to them about that, but I would leave that up to them to explain. But my understanding is that it won't be complicated, burdensome for the state. As you mentioned, we already have an option for withholding, an option for quarterly payments, an option for prepayments. So the dividend would be, in essence, considered another prepayment option that the Department of Revenue would be holding in that tax filer's account, just as they would for any of those other payment options already. And then once you file your tax return, you would know if you would be getting a refund or if you owe money to the state, just like with when you file under a federal tax return. The question on whether you could choose to not have any withholdings because you're expecting to be able to pay it all with your dividend, I would defer to Mr. Spanos on how withholdings work, but I believe that you can set the rate of withholding. It's kind of your choice currently. And as to the dividend amount being changed by the legislature, the intention of this structure is to make the amount that the general fund receives stable, which would remove some of that need for the legislature or desire for the legislature to reconsider the dividend. That's one way that we're hoping this format will protect the dividend, by creating a stable source of revenue for the state government. It is all, you know, the legislature ultimately has the power of appropriation, and so we can't bind future legislators from doing that, but we're trying to protect that dividend calculation as best as possible.
Representative Pruitt?
So at the beginning of the year, I fill out a W-4, and I intend for it to be, here's what I expect my withholdings, and there's then the calculation that's determined. Are we going to have to change, because we don't know how many people have applied for a permanent fund, therefore meaning that we don't understand the amount of the permanent fund, and, I mean, people don't finish filing until March 31st. So we wouldn't have an understanding of a better idea of how much the permanent fund would be. So do we have to change the way in which people file for the permanent fund, or come up with an earlier time frame in which we have to have the amount that it would be, so that if I'm a business owner trying to fit within the W-4 mandates that has been requested of my employee, that I am either not taking more than they should have or taking enough so that at the end of the year they're not burdened. What kind of burden are we? How would that work? I mean, we're creating a burden on that business owner. Do we have to change the time frame in which we calculate the permanent fund?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, and you're referring to using the dividend against the tax payment situation.
Exactly.
So that would be an option for each individual filer. It would not have any direct impact on the employer unless that employee made the choice to change what their withholding rate is. Our conversations with the Permanent Fund Division indicate that there wouldn't be any need to change the way we're filing. Again, Mr. Spanos can talk to how the two funds how the money will be transferred between the departments, but you apply for your dividend by the end of March. You file your taxes in April, or earlier if you are on top of the ball. The dividend is calculated in October, and that my understanding is that October dividend, somebody who didn't choose to apply it against their taxes would just get that dividend in October. somebody who chose to apply it against their taxes, it would be transferred to the Department of Revenue in October, and then when you filed next year's taxes in April, that would be sitting there as a prepayment for those taxes.
Representative Pruitt?
No, I don't have any questions. I'm glad we're presenting something simple to the public here. This is complex. If I'm asking questions, you can understand what the public's going to ask on this. This is pretty complex. Thanks.
Mr. Spanos, are you online? And if you are you would you like to address the question?
Yes, I am. Again, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division. To the Chair, Representative Pruitt, the payment would be just like any other payment. So if someone were to select on their PFD application that they wanted some of that money to come into for a tax payment, we would expect that to be similar to any other scenario where someone would make a prepayment or a quarterly payment. It's unlikely that somebody that's getting a refund would want to make a payment to the tax division. So it would be someone that has done some tax planning and wants to check a box so that they don't have to write a check to the state. The W-4 would be, it's a federal form. We would piggyback the W-4. You wouldn't create two W-4s, one for the feds and one for us. So your W-4, we wouldn't anticipate anyone to actually adjust that just for state purposes. They certainly could. You could adjust it. You could do your own tax planning and determine whether you wanted to adjust it now that there's a state tax if this were to pass. But there would be tax tables for employers to withhold, and we wouldn't be releasing any information to employers on prepayments. So it would be up to the employer to just simply put the data into the system and allow the withholding to take place.
Thank you, Mr. Spanos. Are there any questions of the committee? I've got a question from Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the event that somebody has a tax liability that is more than what they paid in, and they've chosen the option to use their dividend and they've paid in their withholding amounts, but their liability is larger than those amounts, then how do we perceive that? Will we be leaning future dividends, or how would we be handling that?
Mr. Spanos?
If I understood the question correctly, how would we handle it if someone didn't select to make a payment and they owed more tax? Is that correct?
Representative Hilton?
Or if their liability is more than what they pay their quarterly withholding amounts, and they've also paid their chosen to have their dividend taken, and that does not meet the liability amount that they still owe, so they still have amount owing to the state of Alaska. How would we handle that? Would we be leaning the future dividends, or?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, we would handle that the same way we handle it currently with taxpayers. If there's a liability after the tax return's been filed, they'll get a bill in the mail, and it'll have a payment information on it. They would be already late. So after you file your return, normally the payment's due either before or on the same date as the return's filed for the income tax bill before us. It's before you, it's the same date as the return date. So April 15th would be the due date of the payment. So if they still have a payment due, it would be late, and they'd get a bill that says, here's your payment due, interest and penalty, and they'd be required to pay that. If we have a taxpayer that currently any of our taxpayers with 23 different tax types now, if they don't make payments, then we go into collections with them, and certainly we have an agreement with the PFD division to withhold payments if they owe tax. That's one method. Another is that we will levy bank accounts, we'll put lien on property. We're kind of mean that way, like the IRS.
And just as a follow-up, this is Representative Foster. I foresee one issue being you don't know how much the PFD is going to be until the fall, and so without knowing that, you can't get your exact amount due to the state in terms of the income tax correct. I suspect the number of the discrepancy might not be large, but nevertheless, you'll have penalties and interest if there is a shortfall, correct? Mr. Spanos?
To the chair, I'm sorry, was it Representative I didn't catch who was asking the question.
The question was just if you're filing your taxes early in the year and then you check the box saying that you would like your permanent fund to be deducted from the state taxes that you owe, but then if we don't know what the state, the PFD is going to be until that fall, do I have the timing on this correct?
The PFD application will be at the beginning of the year, between January and March, then the tax year is the same year. So if I'm filing for my application for 2017, let's say, I'm filing it now, and the tax wouldn't be due, the tax return wouldn't be due until April 2018, and the PFD announcement would be October of 2017. So the withholding, or rather the payment, so if I selected to make a payment from my PFD, it would be in October of 2017 that payment would be transferred from the permanent fund of the division to the tax division. And I would file my own tax returns between January and April of 2018, and I would know exactly how much was transferred at that time, and if I owed any more or if I was getting a refund.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further questions of the committee? Okay, please proceed with your presentation, Ms. Hansen.
So this just shows the estimated revenue to the general fund. Again, it was based on before I got the new fiscal notes, so this would actually say $321 million in income tax revenue in FY18. But it would still be about $1,840 some revenue to the general fund, with the additional $762 million going straight to the dividend. So that wouldn't be needing to then be paid out of what the money that went into the general fund. And in FY19, which would be the first full year of the income tax, the estimate on the new fiscal note is slightly lower. And I would have to ask Mr. Spanos to speak to what changed in their calculation between the years. I believe it's $640 million in FY19, but then their draw is calculated as slightly higher, as being $1.6 billion in FY19. And so the total revenue is still $2.2 billion to the general fund, with an additional $797 million going straight to the dividend and not coming out of the general fund. So the question, why do we need to take an action on a comprehensive plan that will create a sustainable and stable future for Alaska? To answer that question, we need to first ask, what kind of Alaska do we want to live in? We find out the standard of living and the services that Alaskans think makes this state worth investing in, then we can understand how comprehensive a solution we need for this year and for future years. So according to a poll run by the Senate majority, which was answered by over 700,000 participants, 49.9% of Alaskans believe that state spending is about right or too low, compared with those that believe that state spending is too high. And more Alaskans than in past years are saying that they want to keep the level of state services that they have currently. And out of that same poll done by the Senate majority, when asked whether they could support a state income tax, this year 54.6% of participants said they strongly or somewhat strongly support the idea, just an increase of more than 6% over last year. When looking at a plan to address our fiscal situation, we also have to ask how the legislature's choices will affect the state. And the majority of Alaskans have indicated that they support the current level of spending or that they believe the spending is too low. And as Mr. King demonstrated on Friday, all of the state's choices, all of the choices made will have some effect on the economy, including changing the dividend or implementing a broad-based tax. However, if we chose to not implement a comprehensive fiscal plan and instead continued with major budget cuts as the main approach, the predicted effect on employment would be more severe than our other choices.
Other question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Gurr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's for another day, but I'm looking at Mr. King's presentation, and he had three lines. He had a line with a combined PFD and income tax plan like this one. And that one basically stopped job losses in 2017. And then there was the middle one, which was just the PFD without the income tax, and there were greater job losses. And then the biggest job losses were the loss of roughly 25,000 jobs that persists through the mid-2020s if you just cut the budget by $1 billion and didn't do any of this. So sort of like a 10-year recession. But he had three lines, and I only see two lines there.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, this is a slide from Mr. King's presentation. It's his presentation to Senate Labor and Commerce, and I don't have his presentation to House Finance directly in front of me to see which slide you're looking at. This does have three lines, but the dividend line and the broad-based tax line are essentially on top of each other, and you can't separate them very clearly.
Through the chair.
Representative Gurr.
I think the difference is that top line is an income tax or a restructuring, whereas he had a third line that he gave us, which was a combined restructuring and income tax, which had the least job losses, I think, on page 19 of his presentation from the other day.
We've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So back to the other slide. So where is the impact, you know, on the private sector as oil revenue has been where it is, being able to have any more, you know, continuously talking about oil taxes and not just in the, because we've already heard from the industry last year how many jobs have already been lost in the private sector, not just on the North Slope, but in Fairbanks and Anchorage that are all attached to that industry. Where does that read on a graph like this?
The continued, Representative Wilson through the chair, the discussion on oil and gas taxes, is that what you're asking about?
No, Mr. Chairman, this is not the time or place for that. Jobs lost in the private industry, we always seem to be very worried about government, but what about the private sector and what we have seen in the last year or two because of prices on the oil industry, how now, we didn't see that before, as we have now, as it stayed low long enough, how many jobs have already been lost up there, because all these numbers are based on a pretty healthy oil industry, because that's where a lot of the out-of-state workers, you know, come from, is in that area. So I'm just wondering where the private sector and the losses from the low oil prices, you know, fit into this, and then if we do something like that, how that affects the private industry and the other corporations and businesses that we rely on, mining and other industries.
Representative Wilson through the chair, speaking specifically to this slide, which is looking at employment forecasts for the entire state, I believe includes those losses to the private sector. This is not just looking at state employment losses or state jobs. It's looking at jobs throughout the state. And so that would incorporate the losses that have already occurred are where the lines are all combined, 2015, 2016, and then the deviation is the expected forecast effect on employment for the different choices. If you're speaking to the revenue impacts, such as non-residents, there aren't as many non-residents working in the oil sector now, that may be why Department of Revenue has slightly revised their estimations for the income tax, but I would defer to Mr. Spanos to speak to that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
But those jobs weren't lost because we reduced the PFD. Those jobs were not lost because of a broad-based tax. Those jobs weren't lost because we're cutting the budget. Those jobs were lost because of the price of oil at this point. And you know, so I'm just trying to figure out, and maybe it's just a different slide that needs to be there, and it's not and this particular one, but those three things we have on there are not why the private industry, you know, have seen their jobs reduced and people basically leaving the state because those jobs aren't here any longer.
Representative Kara.
Mr. Chair, if we go back to Mr. King's testimony in his slide 19, his point is exactly what ICER has said for the last year. Every $100 million in budget cuts costs about 1,000 to 1,500 private sector and public sector jobs. And so the bottom line, which is, according to Mr. King, we're down 20,000 private sector and public sector jobs if you do $1 billion budget cuts. That's private and public sector. That was Mr. King's presentation. And if you were able to implement something along these lines, you'd be able to stem the job losses somewhat right away. But it's private and public sector job losses, and you're talking 20,000 private and public sector job losses if you just cut $1 billion from the budget at this point, a budget that's been cut by $3 billion already.
Representative Seaton and then Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, looking at the slide, you know, the lines are going down from a high employment in 2015 of about 465,000 jobs. And so the reduction in those lines you're seeing down to 2017 at about 445 from the 560, those 20,000 jobs are both public and private, and those are actual job losses. It's when you get to 2017 that we are looking at making decisions of how are we going to go forward. And if we go forward to making a decision, so we're reducing the PFD, that's the upper line there that stems the job loss somewhat. And then the same thing with the broad-based tax, having that same effect. Whereas if all we're looking at doing is cutting the economy, that's the dotted line that goes lower, so that you lose about 25,000 more jobs in the next between now and 2020 if you take that route versus the route that we're proposing in this bill, which is a PFD reduction and a broad-based tax and filling with restructuring of the permanent fund for a sustainable draw.
Through the chair, just on the slide, we added the boxes because the lines are hard to distinguish. So those three boxes with the arrows were added to Mr. King's slide because the lines can be hard to distinguish. But I think that the labels are misleading because more accurately has been reported that this isn't showing the jobs that will be lost due to those things, but rather the effect on the economy as a whole under those different scenarios, those choices. So the job losses aren't due to those direct choices necessarily, but to the larger economic effect of those choices.
Representative Wilson.
So I guess what's missing is that we're combining industries, private and public. And so the upswing could be because we're going to keep government going nice and strong. And so that may say we'll have more jobs in that sector. But unless we actually divided those lines talking about which kind of jobs we're talking about versus if we do these things, are we going to see private jobs come back, private industry, or is most of it going to be in the public government industry that we're going to see the uptick? So maybe that's the part that's really missing out of this chart is exactly what type of jobs are going to continue. And from my understanding, it'll be mostly governmental. Is that the kind of Alaska we want, or do we want more of a private sector-driven type of economy? Thank you.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that'd be a good follow-up for Mr. King, but I would note that this slide shows job employments in the thousands, and I don't believe that under either of those scenarios we would be hiring 10,000 extra state employees. So I think that some of those jobs in there would be from, or jobs that would be lost would be from the private sector and not just the state.
Okay, please proceed with your presentation, Ms. Hansen.
On a different perspective of what choosing $100 billion in budget cuts versus a plan that will help stabilize the state's revenues, we would also see potential cost shifts to the communities. This slide was taken from the Office of Management and Budget's presentation at the beginning of the year. It's a hypothetical. They spread a $100 billion budget cut scenario out among the different communities based on the amount of state funds that are currently sent to the communities through education and other services that the state provides, and what that would mean for the burden on the communities to continue to provide the services that they have. So, for the past over 30 years, the state has been relying almost exclusively on volatile resource revenues, which, as I mentioned before, means that we end up with expansions and contractions in the state budget based on a revenue factor that's outside of the state's control. This also means that in years when the state's private economy is shrinking due to decreased oil and gas investment, as we're seeing currently, a state government that's also dependent on that volatile resource cannot help provide a safe glide path for the economy, because the only option is to try and match that greatly reduced revenue resource or resource revenue by cutting jobs and cutting drastically out of the budget, which then has a multiplier effect on the economy. And so to avoid this up and down of the state budget and the state economy, the intention of the State Revenue Restructuring Act is to provide a more stable source of revenue so we don't have these fluctuations and contractions. And this slide just shows that per capita and adjusted for inflation, the state budget has already been reduced to close to some of its lowest levels. So the last thing to consider about why it would be valuable to the state of Alaska to have a stable source instead of a volatile source of revenue is that sheer amount of infrastructure that we've built up over the past 30 or 40 years when we have had funds. If the legislature chooses to cut the budget drastically to meet our expected resource revenue, the first place that those cuts will be taken and have been taken are in the capital budget, and we'll likely see a growing list of deferred maintenance. As I think is most publicly known, that the university alone has deferred maintenance nearing $1 billion. There are a lot of deferred maintenance on roads. The Department of Transportation has their own way of prioritizing how those roads will be repaired and in what order. But if we want to maintain some of our core services and our core infrastructure, it's going to require a stable enough revenue that we can budget in for some of those deferred maintenance costs.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. As I mentioned, we do have a law permanent fund and institute on taxation coming in tomorrow. But if there are any further questions today, feel free to throw them out there. Okay, seeing no further questions, our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 14th at 1:30 p.m. At this meeting, we'll continue on our hearing of HB 115. And to help answer the questions, we've got the Department of Law, Permanent Fund Corporation online, and then also Carl Davis from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. With that, we will be adjourned at 2:57 p.m. Thank you, everybody.